From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening, and welcome to Tuesday Topics. This is Paul Edwards, and I'm in Miami, Florida. I'd like to thank my producer, Brian Charlson, and our recorder and editor extraordinary, Mr. Steve Bauer, who is responsible, perhaps, for what little quality this program has by cutting out all the bad bits and leaving in all the good bits. Also like to thank all of those who have turned up this evening to become part of our recording and part of the discussion of our topic for this evening. And obviously we'd like to thank George Buys and Talking Communities for all of the work that they've done in order to create software and to make that software available to us as well. So George, we very much appreciate Talking Communities and the software. Without it, we very likely would not be doing this particular program. Tonight we're going to be talking about a subject that came up when we actually were discussing the convention this year. And we've also had a number of folks ask that we give some thought to some of the issues that surround it. And that issue is the issue of voting and ACB. We've done programs in the past on elections and on voting in local, state, and federal jurisdictions and all of the problems that are attendant on that. But what we're talking about tonight is voting within ACB itself. And we'll have to see whether we in fact have enough to make a full program of interesting discussion. I think we do. And I guess that where we begin in terms of discussing the voting system within ACB is to talk about how it's done now. And the person who will be joining us this evening as at least the initial kind of back and forther with me is Brian Charlson from Watertown, Massachusetts. Brian, could you start out by telling us how we currently conduct elections within ACB?
Well, there's a couple of things we need to keep in mind. I'm using the broadest sense of the term voting and not limiting it strictly to the issue of the election of officers and members of the board of directors. We really have four different areas that we vote on at the ACB National Convention. One is changes to the Constitution and bylaws. Second is voting on resolutions. The third is elections. And the fourth are procedural votes of one type or another, such as the adoption of reports, the adoption of standing rules of conduct throughout the convention, these kinds of things. So with those four things being what we vote on, we vote in one of two different ways. One, we either do a voice vote. This is the process we use for voting on constitution and bylaws, on resolutions, and on procedures. All votes for elections are done by the second type of voting. And any of these other three can also be conducted in that way, but only if either the chair is uncertain as to which side won the voice vote, or if a set number of individuals attending that year's convention and in the convention hall at the time stand up and request what's called a record vote. Now, a record vote consists of two parts. One is a standing vote. That is, everybody who's duly certified as a member has the right to stand up for yes or no on a given issue, or stand for one particular candidate or another. And a group of individuals, sighted individuals, go around the hall and count everybody's votes. And they place that all one first, four votes, one for every 25 members, when the roll call is conducted. And finally, the record vote is where these two numbers, the standing vote and the roll call vote, are added together. Again, yeas, nays, or voting in favor of one candidate versus another, and the victor or prevailing side is announced from the podium. So that's our elections in a nutshell. Now, how an affiliate chooses to determine how their vote or if their vote is split in terms of the roll call component is solely up to that affiliate. There can be votes where it's a winner-take-all scenario, where the majority within a delegation votes yes on a given idea, and therefore when the roll call component is done, the delegate casts all the affiliates' votes for that, rather than dividing them up proportionally based on who voted yes and who voted no within their delegation. Sometimes delegates actually are sent with a charge by their affiliate, either determined in a caucus if at the convention, or perhaps even by the home affiliate when they were sent to represent them. So that plays a part in that whole process as well. It's true that the majority of ACB's affiliates do not cast vote on a what's called unit rule, winner take all of the delegate votes. But that in a nutshell is where things stand at present.
And I guess I would add to what Brian said a couple of observations, and then I'll kind of turn it back to Brian for our next issue. One of those observations is that Brian is quite right. There certainly is some controversy with regard to the way that particularly the affiliate portion of the roll call vote is handled. And I would say there's even more controversy over the way that it's handled by special interest affiliates. Why should there be more controversy with regard to special interest affiliates? Well, the answer to the question is primarily because not very many people sit as part of special interest delegations. While there are some special interest affiliates who have requested 4 or 5 or 6 seats, most of the time people sit in their state affiliates. And that means that delegates to special interest affiliates who are supposed to be seated within these special interest areas so they'd be available for consultation or for help with how their vote should be counted often are not. And certainly in the past there has been a tradition that people who have controlled these special interest folks don't, for the most part, actually sit there, and sometimes in the past certainly have not made much of an effort to consult others and have used the votes that they have available for special interest affiliates in very political ways, sometimes in ways that may well misrepresent what some members of that special interest affiliate might want. Having said that, let's talk about some of the issues that arise in addition about the current approach to voting. I think another of the issues that arises is whether in fact we are complying with our Constitution by allowing another approach, if we do, to supersede that of a roll call vote and a voice vote being the only two options that are out there. In theory, there is an intermediate approach out there which could involve simply a single standing vote. And the chair in the past has certainly had the right and has chosen on occasion to ask people to stand up and be counted, and rather than going for a roll call vote, simply has gone for a standing vote. And maybe it might be worth our while to pause for a moment and ask Brian first whether he thinks the chair has the right under our Constitution to ask for a pure standing vote. And second, in addition to that, Brian, why don't you comment a little bit about what some of the other issues as you see them that surround our current voting system are?
I will tell you that it's difficult whenever you're dealing with the Constitution to deal with implied power versus absolute power. And I see nowhere in the Constitution where it allows more than two separate kinds of vote, since it enumerates them, and they are the voice vote or the record vote. And the record vote, like I said a moment ago, is a combination of the standing vote and the roll call vote in aggregate.
I guess the real issue is if a president or somebody chairing the meeting with the power to make that determination was to say, gosh, I'm not sure about the voice vote, and I'm not sure how it came out, so what I want to do is I want to do a standing vote, but I'm not going to do a roll call vote because that's going to take an awfully long time, and I don't think we need it. It's not really important, and nobody's actually requested it. So I want to do just a standing vote. Is that allowed, Brian?
Again, I don't know that it is allowed. I would probably be a constructionist on the Constitution and say it's not specified, therefore it's not allowed. I, however, think that it should be allowed, again, as a matter of striking a middle ground between the two extremes and allowing the chair, when in doubt, not to be forced to make a ruling, knowing that it's going to be challenged, knowing we're going to first have to count 28 these days, something like that, 25 to 28 standing members to insist on a roll call, a record vote, and go through that whole process. I would think that it would be in the organization's best interest if the presiding officer had that authority. Again, I don't think they currently do.
Well, we'll see. Down the road, perhaps, we'll see how other people feel. I think, even though there are two approaches to voting which are enumerated, I don't think there's any place in the Constitution where it says that those are the only two which can be used, or which limits the power of the chair by suggesting that he doesn't have the right to exercise the option of another approach to voting should he wish to try and should the membership choose to let him. So my view is the opposite of yours. I think that the chair, because he is not expressly forbidden from doing so, actually does have the right to utilize an alternative approach.
Another issue that I think is important in this whole issue of voting is the whole issue of one person, one vote. Currently, I belong to my local state affiliate, the Bay State Council of the Blind, but I'm also an active member of Guide Dog Users Incorporated, Library Users of America, the Braille Revival League, less active a member, but nonetheless a member of ACB Lions, and BITS, the computer-related group. What's that, another five different organizations that I belong to. And each one of those organizations counts me as one in their total body count to determine delegate votes. So in a way, I'm 1/25th of a vote for the Bay State and 1/25th of a vote for each of these other organizations I choose to pay dues to. And that would be different than somebody who's only a member of one affiliate. So is there truly a one-person, one-vote parity within the organization? I'd say that there's room for doubt in that.
Oh, I think there's room for lots of doubt. I don't think there is. And one of the issues that have been out there, or that has been out there for a long time, is how many people are actually voting on issues. If there are a lot of Brian Charlesons in ACB, and I think it's actually arguable that there are, then do we really have the slightest notion how many actual members we have voting on any given issue? I suppose the other question that we need to ask with regard to that is, does it matter? I think it's arguable if people have paid dues, if people have in effect paid taxation, they have the right to be represented in as many organizations as they choose. This, by the way, is an even larger issue as it operates for state affiliates who sometimes argue that individuals who are members of special interest affiliates, even if those special interest affiliates are active in the state, don't have the right to cast special interest affiliate votes. if we look at the way other organizations of blind people do it, the National Federation of the Blind doesn't count the votes of any of their special interest organizations. Instead, they limit voting to their state affiliates. So special interest affiliates within the NFB actually have no power at all. It really doesn't bear much comparison in that the NFB gives each of its affiliates a vote and does not, for the most part, afford much democracy to folks who are there, except where voice votes and such are concerned. The other issue that came up, Brian, when you were discussing what the chair could or couldn't do, was the idea of quote, tearing off a corner of a piece of paper and casting a vote. And the reason that you gave for wanting to do this was that it allowed for a greater degree of secrecy in the casting of the ballot. And I think it's probably worth saying that one of the largest issues that, in my view, surrounds voting within ACB at the moment is whether or not we have an obligation to change our constitution in such a way as to allow for the use of some component of a secret ballot. If we have that obligation, why? And if we have that obligation, should that secret ballot apply to the affiliate vote within our current record vote, or should it only apply to the standing vote? I'll let you have a first crack at those questions, Brian.
As a preliminary to that, there is one other issue that's already in there, separate of any new ideas, and that is the capping of affiliate votes to no more than 25, so that large affiliates, special interests such as GDUI, and state affiliates such as California really don't get the 1 to 25 delegate vote. This was an attempt during the initial creation of the voting process to keep large affiliates from dominating the organization, similar to why only one representative as a general board member may be elected from the given state, while it's okay for literally all of the officers to be elected from a single state. Again, attempting to draw this balance between the large and the small, not dissimilar to what we do in U.S. government, dealing with a bicameral legislature that allows you to have one body, the House of Representatives, that's based on population and the other is based on statehood. But setting that one aside for a moment and going on to the secret ballot issue, you and I, Paul, at the World Blind Union meetings have gone through more than a few secret ballots when voting for WBU World Blind Union leadership. And it creates a whole set of circumstances that make life kind of interesting. One is when you're casting the roll call vote by affiliate, does your affiliate membership seated in the room have a right to know how their delegate is casting the ballot? You can say, We have all decided that you should cast your ballot for Susan Jones. And then the person gets into the privacy of the polling booth and casts it for Chuck Johnson. How are you ever going to know that your delegate cast your vote the way you directed them to if that vote is not spoken aloud before the entire conference or convention? On the other hand, there's value in, I think, the privacy of the individual standing vote. And I can give a couple of examples. A number of our staff in the national office are also members. And during elections, they might find themselves standing for one political candidate versus another. And one might, in fact, be their current boss, or while another might be their future boss. If it's not a private ballot, then it, I would think, could put them in jeopardy as an employee in a way that I don't think is our intention, but it can nonetheless take place. There's also ramifications when individuals vote and can be seen by two friends, to people who consider themselves both your friends as voting for one and against the other. It's a no-win situation. So I think there is value to the secret ballot. I don't have a good answer to how one can logistically do that, and I think the WBU balloting is an example of how horrible such a process can become.
Yeah, the WBU process really doesn't, while it exercises a secret ballot, truly doesn't, it isn't a representative issue either, because let us say there are 20 people there from the United States at the World Blind Union. It doesn't change the fact that the United States will only, at most, have two votes. And those two votes will be cast by the delegates of the U.S. who are certified to cast votes for those particular affiliates. But there really is no representation for all the folks who are there as there is within the ACB vote. So in a very real sense, even though the World Blind Union has a secret ballot, it's a secret ballot that is limited to the counting of a pretty small number of folks, and it gives absolutely no democracy whatsoever to the vast majority of the individuals who are at a World Blind Union meeting. And so it isn't nearly so democratic as the voting process within ACB is. And I think that it's important that we stop for a moment and recognize the fact that while there's a lot we may not like about the ACB process, if we look around at other membership organizations that are out there and at the way that they vote, there is far more effort within the ACB approach to voting to assure that the affiliates themselves have representation, but also that the people who've paid hard-earned cash to come to convention have representation. And there aren't a lot of electoral systems that are out there that are as open and as democratic in ensuring that both parties, those who have come to convention and those who in effect control affiliate votes, should both be important components in the electoral process.
It brings up another aspect of it, and that plays an important part of this process, and that's the concept of the absentee vote. You may recall that, there might be more people present than there are votes for a given region, but it may be, in fact, the other way around. And there are a single individual who has in his or her hand a stack of 17 votes that they've been given the proxy for to cast as they will when they enter the voting booth. So that plays a part in that scenario as well. The whole idea of democracy in ACB and in blindness organizations is a difficult one. If you look at the word democracy in general, that usually means one person, one vote, we vote on everything. And ACB has never been that type of democracy any more than this nation, that is the United States, has ever been a true democracy. We're a republic, and ACB, in fact, functions primarily as a hybrid of a one-person, one-vote, the standing vote, and a representative vote, the roll-call vote. And, again, an attempt to strike a balance between those two different means of hearing the voice of the electorate. So I would say, generally speaking, doing all one way and none of the other would make me uncomfortable. And I like the hybrid system as a means to mellow things out, the extremes out. It is still, nonetheless, kind of messy, and it still doesn't provide all that I'd like it to provide. And I hope we can share some ideas on what things we might do. And at least in my case, I've been thinking about it quite a bit lately, and I'm interested in tossing out some ideas and seeing how other people feel about them as ways to enfranchise those individuals who don't go to national convention, but who still are members in good standing.
We have asserted to anyone who will listen in the world, our belief, that it is absolutely crucial for blind people to have the right to vote privately and independently in state, local, and federal elections. So the question that arises is, given that stance, is it appropriate for ACB's election to be held as absolutely unsecretly as it currently is, or do we have an obligation to move in the direction of a secret ballot? I think it's important to add to that that there are really a number of affiliates out there now who have come up with approaches for the secret ballot. Many of those approaches involve kind of interesting approaches. One of them involves what Brian described earlier, that is handing everyone pieces of paper and then asking them to deal with those pieces of paper in a particular way and then to fold those papers up in such a way that what they've done doesn't in fact show and put it into the ballot box. It's arguable that taking this approach to elections would make elections take a good deal longer. I think that's in fact accurate. And one of the proposals that's been made is that we begin conducting elections right from the beginning of ACB's week, and that voting actually take place outside of sessions, and that in fact elections are the last thing that we start at the end of each session, and the first thing that we do the next morning as at the beginning of the second section in terms of announcing the results of the election that was held at the end of the previous day. I think Brian and I have probably done a pretty good job of putting things out in the open, so let me pass it back to Brian once more. And then if you're ready to, Brian, you can go ahead and open discussion if you're minded to do that. But I guess the one question I would like you to comment on is to come down on one side of that fence, which is currently doing immense damage to parts of your anatomy because you're sitting on it, as to whether ACB has an obligation to work on a secret ballot or not. And if you like, you can also talk about whether, in your opinion, ACB has an obligation to develop some sort of absentee ballot so that individuals not present at the convention can be heard from. By the way, I would argue with regard to the second question that the answer is a resounding no. We do not have an obligation, and there are fundamental reasons why we should not do it.
Do I believe that ACB has an obligation to find a way to provide a secret ballot for individuals choosing to vote in a standing vote? And I think the answer is yes, that we need to be constantly on the watch for a method to accomplish that without eliminating altogether the chance that we can have any other program at convention other than elections or voting. The method has to be one that would allow the regular business of the day to continue. It can't be one that requires the clearing of a hall, because then we would only, well, among other things, we'd spend all of our time either coming in and finding our seats or leaving the hall. That method may work in part for some types of voting, similar to the WBU. We didn't just, every time there was a vote, we all had to get ballots and all that kind of stuff, but we did have certain activities where ballots were printed, and we would, in fact, cast our ballot during the break kind of scenario. So I think that with respect to the secret ballot, it is a laudable goal, one we should not dismiss out of hand, but one that we have to carefully balance with the logistics of getting the job of the convention done within just 1 week each year. Okay, with respect to absentee balloting, I have real mixed feelings on the subject, but what I did was, similar to my initial discussion, broke it down into those four basic areas. Can it logistically be done without fundamentally altering the nature of the democracy / republic we call the American Council of the Blind? And I would say there are certain aspects of what we vote on that can be done logistically by absentee ballot, for not just for those not in attendance at the convention, but rather for all members through a telephone voting system. And let me toss out an idea for you here. We know that constitutional and bylaw amendments, when reported to the floor of the convention, may not be amended from the floor, but must be voted either up or down in their entirety by the membership. That's a unique status of that one business activity at our conventions. If that is the case, then what is stopping us from, instead of conducting that activity at convention, we were to establish that by January 1 of each year, any individual wants to propose changes to the Constitution and bylaws shall submit those recommendations to the committee by, like I say, January 1. And that by 3 months later, the committee shall have deliberated on them and then shall publish those in the Braille Forum, have a program on ACB Radio which outlines them and gives an opportunity for debate, has a component on the ACB website for the same purpose, including perhaps a blog type approach toward debate, and would be also on the Washington Connection, that all members in good standing will receive as part of their membership a PIN number, which they can use to call into a central number, enter in their PIN, and conduct an over-the-phone balloting on those subjects. Again, no amending is currently possible once it's proposed to the membership, and no amending would be possible if we were to do it by this absentee ballot method. It would also allow the Constitution and Bylaws Committee to report to the convention the results of those elections, and those changes to the Constitution then could be part of that year's convention rather than being implemented at the close of the current convention. They'd be implemented at the opening of the current convention. So that would be my first proposal.
Hello, everybody. This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. No, I think that sounds like a good idea. I think that we need to have the option to have absentee ballots because even though I've never been to a convention, I'm not saying that I wouldn't be interested in it sometime at some point. And it's fun from what I've heard. But also, I think that we should be able to have a right, if we don't choose to go, to be able to vote by absentee ballot, maybe by phone or whatever method that can be done at our homes, because some people can't go because of obligations of some sort or other, work or family, maybe any of those, anything. So I believe that we should have the chance to vote absentee if possible.
Brian, in the first place, I don't know where you're getting the idea that it isn't possible to amend bylaw or constitutional amendments on the floor. There is a long history of amendments to those that can be made. I think there's been a kind of a practice with an ACB to say that you can't fundamentally alter the nature of the amendment, but you can certainly amend for wording. And I think some of that amendment has been really valuable and really important. I think without allowing that amending process from the floor, which I believe has occurred and does occur, I think we have the potential of finding ourselves with amendments that are unacceptable to some people simply based on their wording, which in my view would often result in a net outcome that it would be extremely difficult to get our Constitution changed and virtually all amendments would end up being defeated.
The idea that without the check, if you will, toward the writing of Constitution and bylaws, if we didn't have the potential balance of amending from the floor, would have resulted in some pretty horrific votes, I think it's offset by the idea that we don't know what the Constitution and bylaw amendments are going to be until we arrive at the convention. There are frequently insufficient number of hard copies for us to truly review it. There certainly is very limited time for us to review them, which wouldn't be true if we had allowed them to be published, debated, and voted yay or nay. So I would say that the benefit, in terms of this debate today anyway, the benefit would far outweigh the negative.
Yeah, but I don't see, and we're going to open this one to other people's debating as well, I don't see that we can't actually have the best of both worlds here, Brian. It would seem to me that the reading of the amendment one day followed by discussion, debate, and quote, amendment the second day is intended to assure that decisions that are made on amending our Constitution are deliberate ones, that they aren't taken in haste and that they aren't simply made very quickly without due consideration. And so the first day, people are given an opportunity to read them and hear them. And then there's a whole day that is essentially set aside for private discussion outside of the system. In New Zealand, where resolutions are concerned and where constitutional amendments are concerned, I think, any proposal that is actually going to make it as part of and become, therefore, the policy of the organization has to be circulated to all of the branches of the organization, and each of those branches is supposed to take a look at resolutions and is supposed to take a look at constitutional and bylaw amendments, and allegedly has made decisions that will influence the way that affiliate will vote on the issue under concern, whether it's a resolution or a constitutional amendment. And I don't see any reason why that can't happen, while at the same time allowing for the potential that there will be an amendment that may change the way that amendment will look by the time it's passed. There certainly is, at least with constitutional amendments, even though there's a recognition that they could get amended from the floor, an opportunity for people to really look at them as part of affiliate decision taking, or alternatively, if we don't want to do affiliate, we could do all members, with members having an obligation or an ability to get back to affiliate delegates with feedback once those have been placed on a website or wherever they're going to be. So I think there are some ways to do that, short of the kind of straitjacket approach that you describe, which to me would take a good deal of the spontaneity as well as the appropriateness of decisions taken on the basis of debate out of the way that we would be then doing business with regard to our Constitution.
Rather than stepping in and debating it, I want to invite others to respond to the two points of view.
First of all, I am very strongly opposed to absentee balloting, to absentee voting. I think that there are so many pitfalls with it. I've looked at several possibilities of ways that we could do it, none of which I think guarantee true security and maintain the integrity of the vote. When we've got people sitting in the hall now calling every affiliate within the hall on their cell phones to bargain votes, just the idea of somebody being able to call in or, for instance, say, well, you know, you're going to know better than I will, so Paul, why don't you just cast my vote for me? Here's my password for a telephone system, something like that. I just think that there's no, I certainly mean that as no implication toward you, but I do think that there's just so much room for misuse and for corruption of the voting process with that. As far as what Brian is talking about with the constitutional amendments, I think that it's basically a very good idea. I do believe, again, that we would be going against one of the basic tenets of the organization, which is that the business of the organization is primarily conducted by the convention. What I do wonder, Brian, what you might think of the idea of having a deadline for constitutional and bylaw amendments of, let's say, March 1st, and publishing them for debate prior to the convention, so that we could just do one quick reading of all of the amendments let's say, on Monday, and then be able to vote on them throughout the week as we do now. And that would still maintain the idea of the convention actually doing the voting on them, as opposed to a some other time other than the actual convention.
This is Brian Collins from Long Beach, California. I think absentee balloting of any kind adds yet another layer of bureaucracy, and it also brings in a whole set of logistical issues that are going to cost money and also create a whole new level of interaction that has the potential of becoming somewhat out of control. And as already stated by others, it could be have the potential of being misused. In order for absentee balloting to truly succeed, there has to be some type of system that will be in place ahead of time to let those who are going to be voting by this absentee method, to let them be aware of what's coming up, so that any discussion will somewhat become irrelevant anyway after that is done. One of the challenges that I've always seen in other organizations and institutions with absentee balloting is that the discussion on the floor sort of loses its power and significance, because a lot of people aren't there to be able to hear any additional remarks and comments, and their decisions are made ahead of time. And a lot of those who are on the floor have a tendency to kind of assume, based on what they've already heard from those out there, you know, outside of the floor, who are voting by absentee, they've already said, well, the decision's already gone one direction or the other, so it's kind of useless to continue to have any discussion. I think that the concept on paper is a really good one. However, you know, three objections being, A, logistically, it's kind of a financial nightmare. B, it adds in bureaucracy that no institution and organization really should have. And C, I do believe that we don't want to lose any of the significance of the convention floor itself.
One of our text people, Rick Moran, has raised an interesting question. The venue of a convention and the impact that the venue of that convention has on the way that votes get counted. The example that Rick said is, what would have been the impact had we held, for instance, this year's presidential election, if our convention was being held in Los Angeles? Would that have, in fact, given Mitch, as a Californian, at least the potential of having a lot more voters who he could encourage to come in from the Los Angeles area to vote for him? Or would the result have been different if the convention had been held in Kentucky, Rick says. And I think that it's certainly a question that's worth looking at. I think every candidate, and this, I think this is particularly true of board elections, who's looking at running, makes the location of the convention one of the issues that operates for him or her. In a presidential election or in elections for officers, clearly candidates look at whether they believe that the part of the country that ACB is meeting is a part of the country that's pretty convivial to their approach and their attitude. And so it is truly an interesting question that we have to look at.
I'm going to step in and respond to a couple of Terry's comments and a couple of Brian's comments, keeping in mind, please, one and all, that the concept that I've floated is not one I'm championing. But I think that I am championing the idea that having less than 1 in 10 members present at a convention is unfortunate. I wish that everybody who was a voting member had an equal opportunity to attend a convention. It's simply not the case. It's expensive to go to convention. It's not going to get any less expensive to go to convention. Those conventioners who are lucky enough to have their home affiliate pay some or all of their way to convention, have some obligation to that affiliate to some degree, and can in fact mean that you end up paying for more votes to go to the convention, more of those standing votes. My concern is by saying that absentee balloting is intrinsically a bad idea. You're saying it's a bad idea to allow individuals to directly vote unless they have the moolah to make it to convention. Yes, their vote is counted in the delegate vote, 1/25th of a person if you can't attend. On the other hand, you're 1/125th of a person at a minimum if you can't afford to go to convention, and therefore you have a higher value placed to you as a result of that. I think that you can avoid some of the problems, Terry, that you were talking about in a telephone balloting system if you were to restrict the number of votes that could be cast from a single phone number, no matter what PIN you use. I believe Rick is asking, how about the Electoral College approach? Another possibility, depending on how you establish who's a true candidate. And again, I'm strictly speaking at this point in round one, if you will, on the issue of constitution and bylaw changes. I think an absentee process allows for more thoughtful debate, more inclusive of the entire membership's interest and not just those who can afford to go to convention. The second kind of vote that I'm interested in long term is the concept of resolutions. I have to tell you that I was incredibly disappointed with the fact that we ran out of convention time before we ran out of resolutions, and that the body of the convention voted to refer those resolutions they hadn't even heard yet on to the board, for the board then to be given the authority to act in the voice of the membership and in fact pass or reject or refer to committee or amend resolutions and then have them signed off as if they were voted upon by the body as a whole. I'm looking at a way that would allow us to streamline how we deal with resolutions, and we should explore how resolutions themselves, part of them anyway, could possibly be done by absentee ballot. But I do think that we could take those resolutions that are, if you will, a white paper codification of previous ACB beliefs put into the form of a resolution, write them up well, propose them as resolutions on a consent calendar, and then allow the membership to vote to adopt or not to adopt the consent calendar. If the consent calendar is not adopted, then those resolutions contained in the consent calendar could go before the full membership. But it at least gives us an opportunity to have longer and more thorough debate about a potential resolution, and it gives us an opportunity to move on more resolutions instead of fewer resolutions, as seems to be the current case.
There's been a lot of talk about the use of a consent calendar for resolutions, and I think that most of us who have chaired the Resolutions Committee have actually been pretty comfortable with the use of a consent calendar. The way that I've envisioned it, though, Brian, is a little bit different from the way that you have. By the Tuesday of convention week, a series of resolutions which have been worked on by the Resolutions Committee and conceivably have even been circulated to others or been made available for others to look at prior to the convention are placed in aggregate at a spot where individual members have the right to look at them. They will stay there for a period of no more than 2 days. On Thursday, the chair of the Resolutions Committee would put forward that the consent calendar be adopted, and that is that all the resolutions contained thereupon would be adopted, and a vote to adopt the consent calendar would in effect be a vote to adopt all of the resolutions that are on it. So far, Brian and I are exactly on the same page, and we've essentially outlined the same process. However, what I would propose is that any member would have the right to stand up and request that any given resolution should be removed from the consent calendar. We could certainly say that it might even require 25 people to rise to request that a resolution be removed from the consent calendar. But my intent is not to make this a really difficult process. Then, if there could be no debate on the resolution itself, only debate on why, in the opinion of this person or this group of people, this resolution needs to be debated by the membership rather than simply being adopted. And that would usually mean some fundamental flaw in the opinion of the individual in the nature of the resolution. I think that's a really good idea, and I think it can and should be made to work.
When one talks about a consent calendar, there are certain things that come with that, one of which is how do you take a single item off the calendar and put it into the general debate, and whether or not that's going to be a single individual standing forth and saying that one person is enough to take it off the consent calendar, or whether or not it should be the same number of individuals that is required to insist on a roll call or, pardon me, record vote. I tend to lean in the latter because there's an awful lot of people who would, in fact, it would just take one individual to totally destroy the whole value of a consent calendar by simply insisting that all things on the consent calendar be placed on the general calendar, and you might as well never have gone through the exercise. It only takes one person doing that. I do think a consent calendar probably would be best tried in a non-absentee vote style and cleaned up a bit in terms of procedure before we take it on the road, so to speak. So I'm not by any means suggesting it as a first round. But it's, again, one of those areas where rather than saying outright, no absentee voting, rather than saying outright, every resolution must be reported out on the floor, debated, and cast on, there seems to me to always be a way you can look at things and say, let's talk not about what can't be done, but let's talk about what could be done and the value of taking that alternate approach to what the status quo currently is.
This is Brian again. I actually think that's a very significantly good idea. The only thing that I would ask is, would there be any way for a particular individual to, either prior to or during a particular day, or such as just before the convention or during the early part of the convention, to be able to ask for a further explanation as to what a particular amendment supposedly could be?
One of the ways that we could do that, Brian, would be to actually create what would amount to a resolutions committee blog where people could actually raise questions that then could be responded to on the internet so that everybody would have an opportunity to look at those things in order to try to clarify. And even though it's the way things are done within the NFB, I'm not sure that I don't think that there's actually quite a lot of room for a plenary resolution session that would take place in the evening that could have the impact of determining that resolutions that have no chance of being adopted or that are innately bad for the organization simply won't go forward. And if we create a plenary session, are we in fact limiting democracy at all? I don't think we are, because we're giving people who are interested the right to be there and to participate in looking at resolutions, even though the decision may well be taken not to send those resolutions forward. If you like, this is precisely the opposite of a consent calendar. These are the resolutions that the resolutions committee determines are particularly poor or particularly difficult ones, and they go to the special plenary, will these resolutions survive mode. I guess the only thing I would say in support of my plenary session idea is that the resolutions committee wouldn't be voting on whether they'd go forward. The people in the plenary session would. In effect, what it would be is a triaging that was done by those members of ACB who choose to come to the plenary session in the evening to look at the bad resolutions and to try to determine whether or not we can remove some of those.
This is Jay in Orlando, Florida. Here's basically what my take is on this. The resolution situation has been something I've been thinking about for a couple of years, to be very honest. I really do wholeheartedly agree that they should be made public long before convention, if at all possible. I know there are a few that maybe because of an absolute timing situation would have to wait, But most of the time, I would believe resolutions can be taken care of and made public long before convention. As far as the plenary goes, I think that could work. It's going to be a matter of timing to see what day it can be properly held. And I really do think that resolutions should be dealt with a little bit further in advance.
Thanks very much, Jay. We're actually at a point where we have probably about used up as much time as we have. So the question of whether we could manage to fill a program with debate on some of these constitutional issues has certainly been answered. Let me give Brian Charlson an opportunity to make one last comment on his side of issues.
I only got through about half of what I wanted to say this evening, so yeah, the time was insufficient to cover everything. I really enjoy these kinds of discussions where you can throw out ideas, beat them up a little bit, chop off an end here, tack on something there to try to form something that is better than we started with. And I think that there's been some excellent discussion here that allows for that. I want to throw out a couple things, not for people to comment on tonight, but for people to think about as part of this whole process of getting the business of the convention done, getting more members involved in the business of ACB, and perhaps getting better quality in the product as well. I mentioned that there were two other areas of voting that are of interest here, one of which is the voting on procedures. I would like to know what it is about the treasurer's report and the executive director's report that wouldn't allow those two positions, and for that matter, I'm going to put the president's report in here as well, to be written and published in the Braille Forum immediately prior to the convention, and that we then, rather than having that read aloud to us, taking up convention time to do it, instead we get a chance to read it in advance of the convention, tell our delegates what we think about the quality of those reports and the information contained in them, and the time on the agenda used to read those aloud are instead turned into opportunities for Q&A between those elected leaders and appointed leaders and our membership at convention. Second item, is there something about how we do our elections that needs re-examination in the process? I'm pretty happy with how the convention went this year, in all honesty. I personally am pleased with it. However, I can look at it and say, is there another way we can do it that again gives an opportunity for absentee balloting to engage the other 9/10 of our membership more directly? For example, could we hold all officer elections live and at the convention, but hold board position elections by absentee ballot, not just for those not in attendance at the convention, but for everyone to have an opportunity to vote on those?
Democracy only functions if the people who are entitled to participate truly do. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in to Tuesday Topics this evening, and thank you for listening to ACB Radio.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.